Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. I'd like to remind all participants, your line will be in a listen-only mode throughout the presentation. To ask a question, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, press star 2. This call is being recorded. If you do have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And I would now like to introduce your host for today's call, John McGrath. Sir, you may begin.
Thanks very much to everybody who's joining our press briefing this afternoon. In addition to Secretary Duncan, this afternoon we have Assistant Secretary Carmel Martin, Deputy Undersecretary of Education Bob Shireman, and Budget Director Tom Skelly. The Secretary is going to deliver a quick opening statement, and then he'll take questions before turning it over to Bob and Carmel and Tom. Just a reminder that if you have a question, to touch star 1 on your touchtone phone. That's all, Mr. Secretary.
Yeah, thank you. And as John said, this will be a brief statement, and then we'll just open up for questions for anybody. This budget makes tough decisions, investing in the programs that will deliver results in student learning or any ones that aren't working. It will give educators the resources they need to turn around the schools in most trouble, and it will build a foundation for success in schools for our youngest citizens. It will also give college students the money and loans they need to pay their tuition and give them the assurance that money will be there for them this year and throughout their college years. We're making a huge investment in the reforms that work, turning around schools, improving teacher effectiveness, and early childhood education. For the first time, we're focusing a significant portion of money in the Title I program to give state and local officials the resources they need to make changes in the schools that aren't putting children on the track for academic success. With $1.5 billion available in this budget and the $3 billion already in the pipeline under the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, states and districts will have money to fix schools or shut them down with schools that deliver for students. We will be building on previous investments in improving the way educators are paid by rewarding principals, teachers, and other school personnel who raise student achievement, close the achievement gaps, and working hard to staff schools. The budget will give $517 million for the Teacher Incentive Fund. That will be in addition to the $200 million in the stimulus package and the $100 million already to be allocated under the fiscal 2009 budget. The budget also delivers on President Obama's promise to expand preschool and other services to our youngest children. It will award $500 million for early childhood grants under Title I, helping districts plan how to use the program's money to start or expand preschool programs. It will create the $300 million Early Learning Challenge Fund to help states create or refine their methods of rating preschool programs. And it will offer $50 million to nonprofits and community-based organizations so they can start planning efforts to provide comprehensive services to children and their families so those children arrive at school healthy and ready to learn. This administration is committed to helping any student who wants to go to college pay for that. We announced a series of proposals back in February, but those bear repeating. We will be increasing the maximum Pell Grant to $5,500 with a guarantee that grants will increase by inflation plus 1%. We will make student loans easier to get and more affordable to pay back while saving $4 billion a year in subsidies now going to private companies. Our budget will make all of those investments in students, but we are also committed to being fiscally responsible by eliminating programs that don't work in jobs that aren't critical to our mission. The budget is eliminating 12 programs, saving $550 million in 2010. Research on every single one of these has determined that they haven't been effective enough in meeting their goals. Many of them are too small to have a significant impact in their field, and we'll be able to address the needs through other programs here at the Department of Education. I will also be reducing our personnel costs by not filling the 10 posts for my regional representatives throughout the country. We also have eliminated a very interesting position, one that was actually in Paris, working with the UN Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Not only was the person positioned in Paris, we were also paying heavily for their travel schedule and for renting a very, very nice apartment, because it's a lot of rent. And so we cut all of that out as well. I'll stop there and take any questions you might have, but clearly we're trying to push a very strong reform agenda and be absolutely fiscally responsible at the same time. And we'll open up the questions.
Okay, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. One moment. One moment for the first question. Okay, our first question comes from Lorraine Forte of Catalyst Chicago. One moment. You may ask your question.
Yeah, I would like to know a little bit more about the Title I funding and what's being done with that, and also a little bit more about the teacher incentive grant. How much is going to be in the stimulus, and again, how much is in this budget for teacher incentive grant?
Yeah, there's $517 in this budget for the teacher incentive grant, and that builds upon $200 that was already there. And Lorraine, how are you doing, first of all?
Yeah, hi, how are you, Mr. Secretary now.
Miss talking to you. This is one of the things that I've always said was one of the best things Secretary Spellings in the previous administration did to further our work in Chicago, of really giving us the chance to create and innovate and really support excellence, reward those teachers and those principals that are making a huge difference in students' lives,
mm-hmm.
and rewarding them for driving up student achievement. And former Secretary Spellings had, I think, $100 million to work with, and so this is absolutely a tremendous leap in that investment. But I think there's great, great teachers, great, great principals around the country,
mm-hmm.
and a constant theme of ours has been we can't do enough to recognize and reward excellence.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very significant investment, but there's lots of folks doing very, very innovative work and finding ways to recognize excellence and or recognize that great talent to go work in hard-to-staff communities and make sure students and communities that have been historically underserved have the best and brightest working with them. And as you know, Lorraine, one thing we did in Chicago, there's several really good models out there around the country.
Right.
We didn't just reward teachers and principals. We rewarded every adult in the building.
Right.
Cooking, security guards, lunchroom attendants.
Right.
And as I travel the country, every time you see a high-performing school, you see every adult in that building a culture where they are passionate about children's education, and the custodians are making sure the building is spotless, and the lunchroom attendants are making sure the kids are eating a good breakfast and lunch and sometimes a dinner, and the security guards are making sure kids are going home with their backpacks. And so this is a real chance to work with states and work with districts and reward excellence around the country.
And how much is in the stimulus for teacher incentive, or really school incentive, because it's not just teachers?
Well, on the teacher incentive fund, in the stimulus, there's $200, and this builds upon that investment.
Okay.
It's an additional $517 million.
Okay. And it also, again, this would be, for everybody in the building, depending on how states...
They're different models. That's the
okay.
main model. There are other models. That was the model we employed in Chicago. But there's a number of states and districts doing some really creative things. And this gives us a chance to potentially, through a competitive process, both deepen investments and expand investments where there's already innovation.
Okay.
But also there's a long list of folks who are interested in doing more of this, and it'll give other states and districts a chance to really get in this game.
Yeah, and again, and I don't want to take up all the questions, but the Title I money, can you explain a little bit more about how that's going to work now?
Hi, this is Carmel Martin. The Recovery Act had a substantial increase in Title I of $13 billion. So this budget maintains the base funding level for Title I overall.
Okay.
It does redirect $1.5 billion of that base into administration priorities. The funding will still go to schools with high concentrations of disadvantaged students.
Okay.
$1 billion will be directed towards school improvement, so tackling school turnaround in the highest need schools, and $500 million for early childhood education, so these Title I programs can expand pre-K availability to the schools.
Okay, so that's,
I also have just a clarifying thing on the teacher incentive fund. The current authorizing language for that in last year's appropriations bill limits the compensation to instructional staff. So right now, in current law, they can only use it for instructional staff. They have to come up with, if they want to give it to all of the adults in the building, local funds have to be used for that. In our budget, we asked Congress to modify the program so the types of programs that Arnie funded can be
implemented. Okay. Okay, that's a good point to make.
Well, one more quick thing on the $1.5 billion for school improvement under Title I. We're really trying to focus, with a laser-like focus, on the lowest-performing schools around the country and fundamentally challenging the status quo, either fixing them or turning them around and really putting money on the table so that the best and brightest teachers and principals would be incented to go in there. We also want 40% of the money going to middle schools and high school. And
Okay.
Title I, we don't think it's focused enough on really fundamentally reducing the dropout rate and challenging the status quo of those dropout factories.
Okay.
Making sure middle schools and high schools get their fair share of these desperately needed resources.
Okay, so that's an important point to make, too. Thanks.
Okay, our next question comes from Kate Boudon of CNN. You may ask your question.
Hi, Mr. Secretary. Thanks so much for having this conference call.
Sure.
Just wanted to, if you could describe for us, you talked about 12 programs that you're eliminating as part of, you know, cost saving and, you know, cutting the fat, as I've heard you say before. Could you describe or help just kind of walk us through the decision-making process of how you went about looking into programs and what you decided to cut and how those decisions were made?
Yeah, and let me even start, even before I get to that, we talk about that 550. As you guys know, the biggest cut, which we already announced, but the very significant cut in reallocation resources is the $4 billion, just basically stop subsidizing banks and put all that money into investing our college students. So that's a huge, huge, and somewhat controversial change, where we just said that, you know, we should be in the business of helping, you know, tens of millions of more, you know, more dollars go to students, and not in doing that, helping millions of more students go to college and be able to afford it, and do that without asking for a single additional dollar from taxpayers. So that's actually by far the biggest fundamental change, $4 billion a year in subsidies that are going to go towards students and away from banks. So I want to start with that one. On the $550 million, without sort of going through the details in every single one, what we really want to do is just be very, very clear going forward, is we want to invest more in programs that work, and programs that aren't working we want to eliminate. And as we do evaluations and do, you know, whether it's our internal evaluations or external evaluations, where we see things not working, we want to change direction. And these, while we have unprecedented resources coming into education, we have to make sure every scarce dollar gets used wisely, and there's never enough money. And obviously, we had a very short window. This has been an interesting couple of months where, you know, we were working on three budgets. We were working on the 09 budget, we're working on the 010 budget now, we are working on the stimulus package. And so we had a very short window, and we want to continue to get better at evaluating what works and what doesn't. And part of what we're doing is actually increasing the budget for research and evaluation so that going forward we can make better, you know, data-based decisions, evidence-based decisions on, you know, doubling down or investing heavily in areas where we're really making a difference in student achievement and where we're not, just fundamentally shifting scarce resources into areas of critical need.
If you could talk a little bit more, and you gave one example about this position in Paris. Could you just talk a little bit more about that and what that person's job was?
Yeah.
And was that entire position cut?
I actually applied for the job and didn't get it. So
I want to apply for it, too.
Yeah, sorry, too late. It was a fascinating one, and, you know, I'm learning every day here. But let me walk you through. Since August 2003, the department has maintained a full-time education policy attaché in Paris. And eliminating this position and closing the office will save $632,000 a year. And in 2008, these costs included over $77,000 to rent living quarters. So again, I can only imagine, it must have been a nice apartment, and over $21,000 in travel expenses. And obviously, just, you know, given just the tremendous need in our schools and communities around the country, there's no way that I could, you know, begin to keep this position in that apartment. We can't continue to fund that. Doesn't make sense.
Thanks so much. And is there a list? Have I missed a list or fact sheet? This is probably for John. Sorry, Mr. Secretary, not trying to put you on the spot. Is a list been sent out to us on the 12 programs? Because I know that's something that, you know, CNN loves to learn a little bit more about.
The list of eliminated programs is in our budget book, which is also on the web. If you look at pages 76, 77, 78, describe the list of the programs and describe each of those. It's also on the web.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay, and our next question comes from Justin Pope of the Associated Press.
Yes, hi. Can you just explain the what appears to be a cut in the funding for the HBCUs? It appears to be a small increase in discretionary spending, but a substantial cut overall. When I gather, what must be a mandatory funding stream is factored in. What is going on there, and how should we interpret that?
Justin, this is Bob Shireman. There are three categories of changes in the discretionary budget. There are programs that are eliminated, many, many programs that are funded at the same amount as last year, and some programs, but not a lot, that get increases. The HBCUs, historical black colleges, Hispanic institutions, and some of the other categories all received increases in the discretionary in their discretionary funding. There has been, for a limited number of years, mandatory funds that was paid for by student loan reforms from a few years ago, and those were temporary for those particular years. So they were, when created, when that money was established as mandatory money, it was not anticipated and not authorized as an ongoing program.
Yes, and that the program sunset, so the legislation that authorized that had a sunset built into it. I'd also point out that the administration is definitely committed to strengthening HBCUs and other colleges and universities that have that serve minority populations. And one of the best ways we can do that is by supporting their students. 62% of the students at HBCUs receive the Pell Grant, and one of our major initiatives in this budget is to make that a stable source of funding for students that has automatic increases from year to year.
And what would you say, just the institutions, obviously they've had this money for the last 2 years. A lot of them are facing particularly acute financial stress. I mean, is your message for them just, you know, you shouldn't have expected this, you should have understood that this was a two-year thing? What is your message for them?
I think they anticipated it was only a two-year thing. I think they also understandably will try to encourage Congress to continue it anyway. And I understand that strategically for them.
Great. Thank you very much.
Just quickly, it was always set up as a two-year program, so as we came in, we knew that was coming to a close. Carmel talked about the significant increase in Pell grants, which is obviously going to be a tremendous benefit to children in those schools. And then, as you also know, we have this $2.5 billion proposed and $500 million a year for 5 years in college completion grants. And we want to work very, very hard with states and with universities to make sure we dramatically drive up the number of students not just going to college but graduating, really focusing on attainment. And I, you know, want to really focus on students who come from families who may not have had other family members graduate from college, students who are learning English for the first time, are at-risk population. And if we're going to get anywhere near the president's goal of leading the world again in college completion rates by the year 2020, I think these grants going out to states and to universities are going to be very, very important to drive up attainment rates at universities around the country.
Thank you.
Okay, and our next question comes from Sam Dillon, The New York Times.
Thanks for taking our call. I would like to follow up with the question from CNN on the 12 programs. You can't go through 12. Could you list, say, three programs that didn't work but that you found to be ineffective and have cut, or two, if you want to pick the ones that are the most important, most significant? And then I also wanted to ask, you're cutting $550 million. We've heard in the last day or so that there was a decision to continue a small amount of funding for the voucher program in D.C. And I gathered from what I read about it, this was a recent decision. So it sounds to me like that would have been money that you would have saved, but because there's been a change of heart on that, you're not going to save quite as much. So would this $550 have been a little bit more? And how much was that?
Yeah, it's not a couple things. It's not a lot of money. I think it's 14 or 15 million.
12 million.
It actually doesn't even come out of our budget, so it's budget neutral for us. And what both the president and I feel is that these are children who are in these schools. They're there because they obviously want to be there. They are learning. They want to continue to stay there, and to pull those children out of schools doesn't make any sense at all to us. So to be clear, this is absolutely the right thing to do, but there is no budgetary impact on us, and relatively speaking, it's a very, very small amount of money. A couple programs just to walk through where we're going to go in different directions. We're taking about $295 million out of Safe and Drug-Free Community State grants, which had not demonstrated to be effective programmatically, and these funds were spread pretty thinly. And we want to focus more on national activities, so we think that's a smarter move. The Even Start program, $66 million, we're going to redirect those funds towards more promising and effective early childhood programs, including the Early Learning Challenge Fund. And then a mentoring program that IES found to be ineffective. So we're really just, again, trying to be hard-nosed and go where the evidence tells us. And, where things are working, we're going to invest more. And where things aren't working, we're going to make some tough decisions.
Thanks very much. From whose budget does the voucher program come?
The D.C. appropriations. It's kind of called Financial Services Appropriations Bill.
I see.
Yeah, not part of the Department of Education.
Okay, our next question comes from Maria Glad, The Washington Post. You may ask your question.
Thank you. Hey, Secretary, thank you so much.
Sure.
You've been pushing this huge reform agenda. We see money for performance pay. We see more money for charter schools. Do you consider both of those things part of that agenda, and what else would you point us to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, this is really trying to have a comprehensive approach, and I just feel that this is a major step in the right direction just to walk through the whole piece. We've talked so much about greater access and opportunities to higher education level, and this is obviously unprecedented resources going in to increase that, by far the most money since the GI Bill, just absolutely historic levels. On the K-12 side, a couple different pieces. Again, a dramatic increase in the amount of money going into reward excellence. We want more money for research in there as well, $57 million, so that we can get smarter and smarter going forward. We want to really focus on reducing the dropout rate and focus on turning around schools that have historically struggled. Charter schools got a very significant increase. And there's a small item that that will grow going forward in the out years. We have $10 million for Promise Neighborhoods. And that's really the idea of building upon and replicating what's going on in the Harlem Children's Zone and trying to make sure we're not just strengthening schools, but we're strengthening entire communities in which those schools sit. So I think, and then finally on the early childhood piece, again, unprecedented resources coming on our side to significantly increase access and opportunity and quality at the early childhood side. So I think this budget really enables us to push a very strong reform agenda at all three levels, early childhood, higher ed, but particularly on K-12, and enable us to set a climate where going forward we can continue to get better, but get better faster, because we all feel this huge sense of urgency.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and our next line is with Greg Topol of USA Today.
Hi, Secretary. Thanks again for the conference call.
Hey,
Greg. I wanted to ask a quick question about Safe and Drug-Free Schools Community State Grant. You talked just briefly about that earlier. Can you talk about how you're going to be spending Education Department money on safety now, and whether the new budget represents an increase or a decrease in your funding? I know other departments funded as well, but in your funding for safety.
So we do have an increase in the budget, this is Carmel. We do have an increase for the National Safe and Drug-Free Schools program. So that funding goes out by competition to districts to fund you know, programs and initiatives that have a higher degree of quality. We think having the competitive nature of the program will hopefully drive quality. And it is something that we're committed to increasing investments on in the future, but we need to ensure that the investments are working. The state grant program had pretty steady evaluation results showing that it wasn't having an impact, but it is something that we want to tackle in the future. I think the Promise Neighborhoods program is something that will also go towards creating safer environments in schools and communities for students. The school improvement funding is also designed to tackle school safety and culture whilst improving academic outcomes. I think there's evidence that if you have a more effective instructional environment, schools that also helps to improve safety for students as well.
Greg, this is obviously a strategic play. This is an area where obviously I have a huge amount of interest. And if you think, you know, $295 million sounds like a lot, but when you spread that across 50 states and do it at the state level, you know, that's $5, $6, $7 million per state. And we just weren't seeing, again, from a number of evaluations, we just weren't seeing any dividends, any bang for that buck. And so really focusing the money on a competitive basis and getting it where the action is, which is out to districts, we think that's the leverage point. That's where the rubber meets the road. And so it's trying to work in a different way to actually drive up, to be smarter and more targeted in our investment and to make sure we're getting the kind of results we need for these resources.
Can you say just as an overall number how much you're going to be spending on safety? I know Carmel talked about how some of these other programs will help with safety, but can we say how much?
It's hard to say how much of the $200 million it could be half. It depends what proposals come in from prospective grantees.
And Greg, actually, the number is a hard number. I don't know if you can ask, because you know many districts use, for example, Title I money for a number of sort of safety-related activities. So the expenditure across the country is dramatically higher than any one of these one line items.
But if you're looking for the total for the national program that I mentioned, it's $283
million. How did that I haven't followed that line item.
What's the question, Greg? I'm sorry.
How does that compare to last line item?
It's increased by $110 million.
So a very significant increase there, Greg. Over 30% increase.
And just one more question about the Paris Bureau. Can you talk a little bit more about what this person did as an attaché to UNESCO?
You can't have the job, Greg. So.
More obviously.
opportunities
in my life.
We just saw no evidence of no benefit there. So I don't know what value add they did, but it wasn't worth the investment. Again, it's just sort of a basically try to cut out political hack jobs, and that job we can be done through email and through web, and it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So whether it's my 10 regional representatives around the country, or whether it's that job, it's simply a very poor use of taxpayer money, and we're not going to create jobs for political reasons.
Okay. Thanks.
And our next question comes from Howard Blue of Los Angeles Times. You may ask your question.
Excuse me, Howard, before you go, this will be the last question for Secretary Duncan. Tom and Carmel and Bob are going to stay on the line longer, but go ahead, Howard.
I was wondering, there's a battle in Los Angeles right now over, I hope this isn't far afield, but over how much of the stimulus package should be spent in 09 versus, 9-10 versus 10-11, and the other option is splitting it between those 2 years, and there was concern about a funding cliff if you spend that money right away, and I'm just wondering where you come down on that, Secretary.
Yeah, I don't know the details of L.A. Obviously, this is two-year money, and so spreading it some, again, I don't have any of the specific details there, but just, big picture, spreading it between the years makes a lot of sense, and we want these investments to save hundreds of thousands of teachers' jobs around the country, but also drive real reform.
And it's very interesting. Around the country, you're seeing some very, very innovative ideas coming to the table that is going to, they're going to drive change long after these dollars are gone. I will also add that obviously we're going to have tremendous transparency around how these dollars are spent. But the first question is, we get to the race to the top RFP, the $5 billion RFP for districts. The first question we're going to be asking every state is, what did you do in an innovative way? What did you do creative with stimulus dollars to fundamentally drive up achievement and close the achievement gap? And if states don't have an answer for that, if they're investing in the status quo, not really moving the bar, they might as well tear up the application, because they're going to, you know, they're not even going to be in the ball game. And so we're going to watch very, very closely and have both carrots, real carrots, but also sticks for folks that aren't doing the right thing by children. So it's a, that's a broader, that's not speaking specifically to LA at all, but just sort of in a bigger context, letting you know how we're viewing these dollars and how important both saving and creating jobs and driving a real reform agenda is to us.
And lastly on that, to what extent does this budget, this new budget, make permanent Title I and special ed increases that were part of the stimulus package?
It doesn't. It doesn't.
One time.
And just on those ideas, a couple quick thoughts is, again, is historic investments there on the IDEA funding, really making sure that, again, these are just suggestions, these are just ideas, but a massive investment in professional development so that every teacher can be a teacher of special education students and do that well, we think would fundamentally change the quality of education around the country for students with special needs. And if we're just working with special education teachers, we're not reaching the vast majority of teachers around the country. There's a real opportunity here. Secondly, on the Title I dollars, again, focusing not just on the younger children, but on middle school and high school is hugely important to us, really challenging the status quo there, and using these dollars to think very differently about time. More time for children, more time for adults. We have districts that are going to bring students back the summer early, which we think is hugely important. And whether it's lengthening the day, whether it's lengthening the week, whether it's lengthening the year, there's a real chance for folks to be creative with Title I and IDEA dollars to fundamentally change the quality of education for children in their districts. I have to step out. Thanks so much. But the team here is a lot smarter than I, and they'll stay with you for a while longer. Thank you for having me.
Okay, and our next question comes from Frank Wolf of Education Daily. Sir, you may ask your question.
I was just wondering, in terms of the Reading First funding, I didn't really see that. Obviously, the program's going away, but what will replace Reading First? And the question for Safe and Drug Grants, that is sort of spread too thin. I noticed also that the new Title I early childhood grant, the $500 million, some may contend, I would guess, that that might be spread too thin as well. So I wondered if you could address those questions.
So on Reading First, there is a new initiative in the budget that funded at $300 million for literacy initiatives in the early grades. This is an area that both the President and Arnie believe are critical to student success. So we have an increase for the early Reading First program.
And we have the increase for $300 million for what we are doing is building on our Striving Readers program. Striving Readers is a program that's focused on middle school and high school students. It was funded at $35 million. By itself, we're doubling that to $70 million. Then we're trying to take the same sort of model that we use there and expand it to earlier grades. After early Reading First, we saw that it wasn't all that effective in improving the comprehension skills of student readers who got up maybe to fourth grade after having done better on decoding and basic reading, but got up farther along in school and saw that they couldn't use the language real well that they were reading. So we're looking at that as a possible emphasis. There maybe are things we've learned from Reading First that we could use in other research and try to let schools have a chance to, school districts to compete and see how they could continue improving reading.
So it builds on the positive aspects of Reading First, but tries to address some of the weaknesses in that program. And it would be sent out on a competitive basis, so the grants would be of sufficient size to really make a difference in the districts that receive them. But the idea is to identify promising practices, fund them at the local level, have a strong evaluation component. We have a significant increase in our research budget to be looking at reading interventions and identifying what works best. And the idea is that we would grow the program over time so it can have a larger impact, but hopefully part of its impact will be in identifying what works effectively so that schools can use other sources of funding. As you know, a large portion of Title I funding is used for reading initiatives. So the idea of this program is to help to leverage existing resources as well as to identify, evaluate, and scale up promising practices.
Okay. And did you page the $300 million early literacy initiative is mentioned on in the budget, or
in our document, it's on 24, the bottom of 23 and the start of 24. It's under the rubric of striving readers again, but it breaks out the adolescent literacy grants from the early literacy grants.
Okay.
And then immediately following on page 24 is the early reading first grant.
Oh, okay. Great. Okay. And I guess just in terms of the Safe and Drug-Free Schools grant, the contention that it was sort of eliminated because it was spread too thin. When you look at it, about $7 million per state, and I guess that would be about $11 or something like that per district. Is that about right? Or?
Well, I don't have it.
Some of the school districts, about half of them get less than $11,000.
Okay. And just in terms of why that spread too thin, because you look at some of the other programs in the budget, which are sort of comparable in terms of amount. I mean, obviously, the early childhood, the new Title I early childhood grants is more significantly, you know, $200 more. But when you take that over the number of school districts, there might be some contention that money might be spread too thin as well. So I'm just wondering.
Well, that money is targeted on school districts with the highest proportion of low-income students, and it is not the only source of funding for early childhood education. Obviously, in the federal budget, we have the Head Start program, the Early Head Start program, funding for child care programs. So it is one in multiple strategies at trying to get at additional access to early childhood education.
Okay.
While we simultaneously tackle the issue of quality through the Early Learning Challenge Grant Program, which is funded in this budget at $300 million.
Okay.
And again, that's an area that the President and Arnie are committed to seeing additional investments in the future.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, our next question comes from Kelly Field of Chronicle of Higher Education. You may ask your question.
Thank you. I was wondering what it means when it refers to PAL as an appropriated entitlement. Does that mean some of the money would be mandatory and some would be discretionary? How would that work? And then also the slight cuts to work study and SEOG, wondering why those programs were targeted for small cuts.
One, work study and SEOG do not have cuts. You might be looking at the OMB budget document, which lists obligations for programs as opposed to budget authority.
Mm-hmm.
Obligation results from budget authority for multiple years.
Right.
It's one way of measuring things, but if you're talking about decisions that policymakers choose to make, you look at budget authority.
Right, okay.
It's the same for both of those. Pell would be an appropriate entitlement. There are other programs that work like that in the government with our Labor HHS Education Subcommittee where they appropriate an amount of money, but the amount of money they appropriate is fixed. We have one, Vocational Rehabilitation State Grant. Congress appropriates an amount each year, but it's classified as mandatory. It doesn't get counted as discretionary and force Congress to choose not to spend money on other programs.
So Congress wouldn't have any say over the levels? That would be set by a formula, or how would the level of funding be determined?
It would be just as, Bob, it would be just as we had proposed in February, which is,
okay,
would be the CPI plus 1% over,
right,
over the prior year funding, and so it's not a change it puts it a little bit more in the purview of the Appropriations Committee than some other entitlements would tend to be.
So what's the advantage of doing it that way then?
Well, the program is currently has a significant role for the Appropriations Committee, and so this would maintain a role for the Appropriations Committee. And as with any entitlement, they are more secure than discretionary funding because they don't compete. But Congress can, in any entitlement program, enact a law that changes the level of benefits and reduces or increases spending in that program. So the Appropriations Committee, for example, could put more money into Palisades if they wanted to in this kind of a situation, but there would be a set standard amount and increases over time that would be the planned flow that would occur if they didn't make any change.
Oh, okay. So they could change, like, the CPI plus one if they wanted then?
They could, they could if they wanted to do more or theoretically less. But the key here is that if we succeed in getting more people to go to college, we won't run into the problem of the money for that competing with National Institutes of Health and things like that, where we could end up with a reduced Pell Grant because it's not out of the discretionary spot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
We're going to take just one more question. Tom and Bob and Carmel need to get to a briefing in another building, and so we're going to just take one more question.
Okay. Our next question comes from Allison Klein of Education Week. You may ask your question.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the $50 million high school initiative, why the emphasis on that, and how would that program be structured?
So it would be a competitive program. It's designed to identify promising practices around dropout prevention. We're looking for a focus on using data to identify students at risk of dropping out as early as possible. So the funding is designed to go not just to high schools, but to a high school and its feeder schools, so that we can identify students early on and test out promising practices in terms of interventions with respect to those students. And the idea there is that we would fund promising practices, evaluate them, and hopefully be able to disseminate best practices that could be used in other funding streams, including the 40% of the $1.5 billion school improvement fund that's included in the budget. 40% of that $1.5 billion is intended to be directed at secondary schools, again, both middle and high schools, and really trying to get at the issue of dropout factories and helping to turn around those schools so they not only improve academic outcomes but also graduate students ready to succeed.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. That concludes the press briefing. If there are folks who didn't get their questions answered or people who got questions in but have some further ones, please give us a call at the department's press office. Thanks again.
This does conclude the call.